This is Smeagol. When I'm not trying to protect my precious from wicked, tricksy hobbitses, I'm listening to the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. They talk about many things that you filthy fanboys will love to listen to. And while you're listening, make sure you follow them on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and any social media on which you can find them. What is Twitter? Is it a bird? Is it tasty? Can I eat it? I can't eat Twitter. Smeagol is so sad. Smeagol wants to eat Twitter. Well, if I can't eat Twitter, I'll go listen to the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. It will make Smeagol happy again. Happy, happy, happy! Just make sure you don't touch my precious while I'm listening.
Fanboy.com.
Shall we just begin with our chat, our interview?
Yeah, whatever you would like, however you like to structure your show, that's perfectly fine with me. I'm your guest.
Absolutely. So, okay. We just start off by saying that my name is Christian Horn. Mm-hmm. This is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. I have a very special guest on the line whose name I just discovered a couple of minutes ago. Did not know who was joining us, but now I do. Dalton K. Shannon. Did I get that name pronounced correctly?
That is correct. Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. And you are one of the writers, co-creators, I would assume, of Frankenstein the Unconquered.
Yeah.
So far, so good.
Yep.
Awesome. Awesome. And you're also part of, is it a collective? Is it a studio? Like, what is it exactly? Because I've been told, originally I was told I would be interviewing Four Colors. And
yeah. So Four Color is a loose kind of branding that Wells and I do for our work. We can get more into the origins of Four Color during the podcast if you'd like, but
sure.
It doesn't really mean anything. It's just what Wells and I, it's the stamp we put on our books that we work together on.
Gotcha. And Wells, we should say, is Wells Thompson, and he is the co-writer, co-creator, correct?
Correct, yes.
Awesome, awesome. Mm-hmm. But you are Dalton K. Shannon, and correct. Your book is Frankenstein the Unconquered, mm-hmm. which I very much enjoyed, very much up my alley, very much liked. And
<Hell yeah.
laughs> I always like to say, you know, right off, again, I'm a little unclear. The communication has not been completely solid before we did
correct.
This interview. But you, I always like to say off the top, you have a Kickstarter currently, or one is coming, or there is
yeah,
a Kickstarter happening, correct?
Yes, it's coming on September 19th for
awesome.
Issue 1 and 2 of Frankenstein.
Okay, great. For issue 1 and 2. Well, so I have read issue 1,
mm-hmm.
which I'm assuming was the available issue. And I very much enjoyed this. I
awesome.
Thought it was a very good, solid sort of book. It was very much up my alley. I am
awesome.
A big lover of like horror and mm-hmm. Hammer
hell
Studio
yeah.
stuff, you know, like
yeah.
the old Hammer horror stuff. And just having read this the other day, I'm going to assume that you are too, right?
So I'm a Universal horror guy.
Oh, gotcha. Okay, okay.
Hammer is actually a sad blind spot in my fandom. I've watched a few here and there, but I've never made a dedicated attempt to watch the horror Hammer franchise. It's something I've been needing to correct for years, and it's just a sad blind spot.
Sure, Sure. Well, yeah. It's interesting because, I mean, I'm looking at you on video. You do not see me right now because this is an audio podcast. You are, oh, okay. You seem to be very much younger than I am. So I can understand why you're not caught up on like Hammer Horror. Like that sort of stuff would be on TV all the time as I was growing up. So I'm assuming that, you know, you seem like a very fresh faced young man. and, you know, I'm just I can imagine that you may have not have been exposed to that. But if you're writing this, I would think it's something that you might want to be like seeking out.
Yeah. Like I said, a handful here and there, they have they actually have a TV program, Spengooly, on cable. And sometimes he'll play Hammer monster movies. And what was it? The Daughter of Dracula or something like that. We watched that one like about a month ago. They're available, and I need to actually go and buy the box set collections of them because I have to see what the successor to Universal was.
Well, some of my favorites. I know a lot of them, I think maybe just around Halloween time, they become available on HBO Max. HBO Max does not sponsor this podcast. We are not affiliated with them in any way. But if you want to check them out, sign up for that HBO Max thing and just, you know, download them into your eyes as it is now, like the way we absorb media content. But why don't you give me sort of like the elevator pitch as far as, you know, what this book is? Because again, I very much enjoyed it. I will say again that if you are into, like you said, you're a fan of Universal monster movies, I'm a fan of both Hammer and Universal, that if you are a fan of either of those things, you will enjoy this book. So why don't you just give the elevator pitch?
Yeah. So like you said, it's a love letter to not only Universal horror and Hammer horror, but it's also a love letter to like the pulps and Conan the Barbarian and metal and all of that. Like we like to say that if it belongs on a Megadeth album cover, it belongs in Frankenstein. We wanted to take the horror of Frankenstein and mash it together with the over the top kind of violence and fantasy that Conan the Barbarian can offer. And it's a wild ride in a post-apocalyptic wasteland where he can fight monsters with swords and everything in between.
Yeah. Well, that was the other thing that I noticed too, was Conan the Barbarian. I mean, it very much reminded me of that sort of thing as well. And all that, you know, great stuff. So for me, again, just noting, not trying to be ageist, that you seem to be a little younger than me. And obviously never wanting to sort of sound like I'm speaking down to somebody who's younger than me or a generation. But how did you discover Universal horror movies or that sort of thing? I mean, like I said, I'm looking at you on video. You have an Iron Maiden shirt. Like all of that stuff was particularly...
Actually, it's a Metroid shirt in the vein of
Iron Maiden. Oh, it looks like Iron Maiden. Okay, gotcha. Yeah. Oh, sorry, mistake. So
no, big Maiden fan too, but it's actually Metroid, and that's why I got the shirt. But,
it looks great, by the way. It's a nice shirt.
So I turned 30 in December.
Oh, okay. You look significantly younger. Good for you.
Well, thank you. I'm having existential crises every other day because of it.
Oh, but, no. Well, I just turned 50, so try that on for size.
Growing up, the millennial generation, it feels might have been the last generation of cable TV consumption. I still actually have a cable subscription
because
just like having TV, just having it on. I don't have to like pick something off of a streaming service, and I can just have Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives playing in the background while I'm doing whatever.
Sure.
When I was a kid, like maybe 5 or 6, it was Halloween time, and it might have been Turner Classic Movies or TLC or somebody was doing a Universal Monster marathon. They were just like every night. I want to say Whoopi Goldberg was actually
really
the in-betweener host on it. I may be misremembering so many things because it was ages ago.
Sure.
But my dad had the wherewithal to actually like get a video cassette and put it in the VCR.
Nice.
And so I just had Wolfman, Frankenstein, Dracula, Creature from the Black Lagoon, all of those greats just on a VHS that I could binge to my heart's content about like Godzilla movies. So I would just watch them over and over, and Universal really kind of sunk into my psyche and my subconscious. And my wife, actually, while we were dating, she got me for, I think it was our first anniversary, like the huge DVD box set of every Universal monster movie.
Oh, wow. And
there was a lot of those I had never seen, just because they're readily available. So I got to watch like Son of Dracula, all of the Mummy sequels.
Okay.
Invisible Agent. I'd never heard of Invisible Agent.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was, I kind of stumbled into it as a kid, as I think a lot of people stumble into their obsessions.
Sure. Or are passed on from their parents, right? Like your dad. Very kudos to your father for passing that on to you. I mean, one of my big memories from my daughter was, I'm a bit of a like artist myself, and I was at a charity event, like drawing pictures for kids with cancer, and somebody drew a Bugs Bunny, and the kid was like, "Who is that?" And and the kid did not know who Bugs Bunny was. And I literally was like, no. I went home and bought the Blu-rays of all the Looney Tunes stuff. And I was like, I am showing this to my daughter. And to this day, she's like a huge fan. Like, she just loves it. So it's just, it's also
Bugs Bunny. What do you do?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So like, kudos to the parents who are passing these things down as well. Absolutely. So I'm imagining that out of all these Universal movies, it was Frankenstein would be the one that kind of like got your, because I mean, your book is called Frankenstein, the Unconquered, right? Would it be Frankenstein was the one that was your favorite, Bride of Frankenstein? Which one kind of just so, like tapped into you?
Honestly, I had to grow into Frankenstein.
Oh, really?
As a kid, I was much more into the Wolfman and the creature.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, like they were just more visually appealing to me as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
So I had like a Wolfman mask and the whole, I was much very into werewolves for a little bit as a kid. But as I got older and I started to appreciate them not so much as monster movies, but like films in and of themselves, Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein are far and away the best of that entire slate of films.
Yeah.
And like Karloff's performance in both of those is, it's transformative. Like they're works of art. Mm. And so as I got older, I even went to film school for a little bit.
Nice.
I grew to really appreciate Frankenstein, and he's my favorite Universal monster now. I still got a soft spot for the creature and the Wolfman, of course. But,
sure.
But Frank takes the cake. And
Frank.
It was. And also Frank just lends himself more to adaptation. Like he's kind of like the Batman of Universal Monsters in that you can make him as silly as Adam West's Batman, or you can make him as gritty as Nolan's Batman, and it all feels right. Like it nothing feels like untrue to the character. Mm. You can do anything with him. Whereas like if Dracula, you maybe tweak it a little too much, it might feel not like Dracula. But Frank, I originally wanted to do Frank in space with swords and ray pistols and things like that. And, eventually we're like, you know what? Conan actually melds really well with the long hair and the musculature and, the monsterness of it all. So, yeah, Frank's definitely my favorite, and he's been so much fun to write.
Sure. That's great. I mean, one of the things I kind of wanted to ask you about too, is that at least this first issue, Frankenstein, the Unconquered, you just said you wanted to do Frank like in space. I mean, part of this book kind of like deals with that. And I don't know that there was a part of me that was like, oh, is this a sequel to something else? Did I miss something? Was there a series before this that I didn't like realize happened? So I guess asking you about that, because I mean, in this book, and you know, I don't think it's spoiling anything, he literally kind of like falls down from space, right? And there's a little bit of a reference to possibly him being exiled to space or something at one point. Was there something before this, or is this just like your first series with this character?
So Frank has been with us, Wells and I, since we began collaborating. So it's been about five or six years now. Four Color was this idea of like a creative unit that we would each be a part of. We started off doing 8-page comics in Ashcan form. So we would write them out. I would hand draw them, and then we would like print them off, staple them together, and take them to cons.
Oh, cool.
They're not very good, but they're there. And Frank was one of the first things we ever did together. We did about four or five of those ash cans, and they form kind of like the spine of the first arc of the ongoing series that we're doing now through Kickstarter.
Oh, that's cool.
So like all the beats are there. We're definitely changing things and beefing things up. We even had the ash cans themselves adapted into our anthology through Caliber Press called Descent into Dread, where we worked with a whole bunch of talented artists, brought a lot of those ash cans to life with actually people who knew how to draw. But Frankenstein also got adapted into there. And so Frank's always been with us, and that initial space idea kind of went out the window because it was such a primal image of watching Frankenstein literally riding a shooting star to Earth while he's like stabbing it with a sword. Yeah. and so the bulk of that first arc is Frank seeking revenge on the people who exiled him to space. Because after he thaws from the ice, it's the sequel to Shelley's novel. So he thaws from the ice 500 years in the future, and he basically becomes a god. Like he conquers continents and is pretty much a blight on the land. And eventually enough people get together where they can overpower him, and they shoot him into space, hoping that he never comes back. And he kills the heavens to come back to Earth and get his revenge.
Wait. So is that stuff in your ash can?
No, that stuff's not in the ash can either. That's all alluded backstory.
Yeah, okay, gotcha. Yeah, that's what I was... Yeah, understood, yeah. Understood.
So you haven't missed anything. A lot of those pieces get filled in within the first arc. The space stuff specifically, we've talked about maybe doing like a prequel series of Frank in Space, because that's almost too good to pass up on its own.
Sure.
So hopefully someday we can come back and do like Cosmic Frankenstein. That would be great.
Nice. Are you offering those ash cans like on the Kickstarter at all, or like digital versions of those, or like
The ash cans themselves, I believe for the first campaign we hit a stretch goal where everyone got a we may have missed the stretch goal, but everyone was going to get like a physical copy of the original Frankenstein ash can. We haven't offered those physically or digitally because they're very, very, very rough. But we do offer Descent into Dread through the Kickstarter as like an add-on you can get. Okay. And those Frank stories, like I said, got adapted with a significant facelift in that anthology. So if you're looking for Frank's quasi first appearance, it's in Descent into Dread.
Gotcha.
And you can kind of experience it the way most people ended up experiencing Frankenstein. But hey, if you guys want the physical editions of the ash cans, we'll hit some milestones, some stretch goals, and we can try and get those into some hands.
That's great. So wait, with the ash cans, and not to dwell too much on those, who drew them? Did you guys draw them yourself? You said artist.
Yep, that was me.
Oh, nice. Great. Yeah, I'm dying to see that, because I always love to see the stuff that people like, you know, blood, sweat, and tears before they felt like that they... You know, like you said, like people who knew how to draw, but like I'm fascinated with, and I actually like, you know, the raw stuff. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Am I making any sense there?
Oh yeah, no, the appeal is there. I love seeing the raw stuff. It's just when the raw stuff is your stuff, it's a little like, I don't know if I want to show this to people. I can't draw. So I desperately am trying to improve my drawing abilities. But man, those ash cans are rough.
Yeah, but you had enough confidence in them to go out and sell them at conventions. I mean, that says a lot for you and you know, your partner.
It was an act born of desperation, because it was, you know, growing up, I've only wanted to do comics my entire life.
Really?
Like that's always been there's no plan B.
Okay.
So as a kid, I desperately wanted to just do comics. And the older I got, the more I realized that my art wasn't so great, but I was pretty confident in my writing. Mm-hmm. But I leaned so heavily on it that by the time I was like out of college, I realized that, oh, wait, no one's going to draw my stupid stories. Like, especially like with the zero amount of funds that I have to actually compensate an artist.
Sure.
So I had to, that was kind of my wake up call to be more assertive with my creative career. And so I was like, I guess I'm just gonna have to draw it myself until I get enough eyes on it where they're like, this art sucks, but man, these stories are good. And that's what happened. We actually met our editor who's working with us on our other Kickstarter book, Mechaton. We met him at a convention where we gave him some of the ash cans and he was like, oh yeah, these stories are great. I can't use this art. But he got us in touch with a bunch of great artists that were able to work with us on Descent into Dread. And that's actually where we met Mary, who is working on Frankenstein, the ongoing series right now.
Nice.
And
so Mary Landreau, correct?
Mary Landreau, great, great Canadian artist. She's a delight and a half. I think she's like 24, 26, something like that.
Oh, wow.
She's a blast, and she's so, so good. Brings all the energy and emotion into the page. She actually didn't work on Frankenstein in the anthology, though. She worked on a separate little horror sci-fi story, but we liked her art so much, we're like, we have to have you for Frankenstein.
Sure, and, sure.
And here we are now.
Yeah, good choice. And I should also say colorist Dahlia Maha. That may be right?
You did, yeah. Dahlia is, she elevates everything on the page. Like Mary's inks, like the bare black and white is so powerful.
Yeah, they look great.
Every time we get the line art in, it's like, I don't know if we should put this in color. Like we've literally thought of maybe just doing like a black and white edition of Frankenstein. Cause you know, that's very universal in and of itself.
Yeah.
But then we get Dahlia's colors and we're like, oh no, we can't, we have to have the colors. This is too good. I can't not have colors on this now, especially when it gets like, you get all the cosmic stuff and the blood and the colors that brings is, oh, it's so good. I don't have a lot of words for it.
No, it is very good. It's all very impressive. And I should round it out by saying Nathan Kempf is the letterer and Brenda Snell is the designer on the book. I mean, everything looks incredibly professional, you know, and I interview a lot of like different Kickstarter creators at different, you know, areas of, you mm-hmm. know, like I'm very welcoming to whoever wants to come onto this podcast because sometimes, and you know, we don't always do interviews, but it takes two to tango, right? And if somebody Absolutely. Wants to come on, I try to be as welcoming as possible. I don't always get to everyone because it's called Part-Time Fanboy, but like this book looks like very, very good. I mean, very professional. Anything that you would see probably coming from like Image or the Big Two. I mean, it's comparable, just to let people know.
That's fantastic.
I mean,
that's what we're going for. Like we have to stand out some way, and getting the best talent we can is how we do it. We're just the writers. Like we're the guys who just like throw shadow figures up on a page and we're like, draw this. But it's really the talent on the back end of the book that makes it what it is. Frankenstein, I mean, and also Heather Vaughn's covers are like, Frankenstein would not be the success it is. I'm almost certain without Heather's striking covers.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, everything looks great. I mean, it's an incredibly mm-hmm. professional-looking package. I'm scrolling through it on my tablet right now as we speak, mm-hmm. and just very impressed. And very impressed from the moment that I opened it, I was like, oh, this looks great. I mean, again, comparable to anything on the stands, and very impressed. But I mean, I would say that black and white edition, that might be another mm-hmm. good stretch goal for you because
maybe once the first arc is done, maybe we can offer.
You're like, take it easy, Christian. Slow down. I'm just trying to get through this. So explain to me how, because I'm always curious. Again, you said you were 30, I'm 50, so we have a 20-year age difference. You're mm-hmm. probably like born like 92 around then. So mm-hmm. I'm always curious, people who are a bit younger than me, I guess, significantly, how you discovered comics, because I'm assuming you're born around 92. And by that time, there's like not necessarily newsstands like for old folks like me. What for you was sort of like the gateway to getting into comics? Because I mean, it's always interesting for me mm-hmm. to hear, because I hear a lot on this podcast and, you know, again, nothing against anybody, but it's always like, I had a script or I wanted to make a movie or I wanted to make a TV show and I decided to make this. And you're like, no, there is no second. I want to make comics. Like so where does that, how did you discover comics and where does that passion for, you know, making comics come from? Because, I mean, obviously at some point, right? Like, was it your dad, like, recording the Universal, you know, things off a Turner Classic Movie? Did he pass comics down to you, or like, how did it work?
No, my dad is very much what you would call old fashioned. He's a blue collar guy. Like, okay. He's a very supportive father, and I love him to death, but he does not get it. He doesn't get it. Like, he's not into comics.
Oh, interesting.
He's not into comics or superheroes or video games or any sort of like nerd stuff. He's very like salt of the earth kind of guy.
Okay. But he recorded movies off of Turner Classic Movies for you, so that's good.
Yeah. No, he has always been so supportive. He actually got, like, when I was getting into comics, it was early 2000s, but okay. We had found a comic shop nearby. I had no idea comic shops even existed. And then my parents took me to one. I was like, oh my God, these places are real. And
yeah.
Underneath the glass was a copy of Amazing Spider-Man 300.
Okay.
At the time it was like an $80 book.
Oh, wow.
I showed my dad, cause like I had this big like Spider-Man encyclopedia. And so I knew what that issue was. I knew it was Venom.
So you knew Spider-Man, like, from what, cartoons and stuff?
I guess I should back up. So I first discovered superheroes through cartoons. So okay. I was born in 92, so that puts me in the era of Batman the Animated Series, nice. The Spider-Man cartoon, X-Men. I was absorbing all of this.
Okay, great.
I didn't even know comics existed until I was...
Oh, my
God. Cartoons, right?
Yeah. No, I understand, but for me, it's just like, for somebody who grew up in an era where it was like... You know, Super Friends, which, you know, I loved as a kid and all that stuff. And just to hear somebody always be like, oh, I discovered it through cartoons. And then like for me, it was like comics first. But anyway, go on.
So I was eight, and we were at a local grocer near home called Knight's. And actually, I'm convinced I may be the final person to ever pull a comic book off of a newsstand. They had a spinner rack in this old grocery.
Oh, really? Okay.
They had all the latest issues, and I pulled Peter Parker Spider-Man number 15 off of the spinner rack because Spider-Man was my favorite from the cartoons.
Sure.
And it was a striking John Romita Jr. cover, and I fell in love. I was like, wait a second, Spider-Man's in these two? And then I was like... And there was no going back. I was obsessed with comic books. And then about the same time, I discovered Dave Pilkey's Captain Underpants series of novels.
Okay, sure.
And in those novels, the main characters are 8-year-old boys who make their own comic books about their own superhero.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, well, if they can do it, I can do it. Easy. That, duh.
That's great.
I grew obsessed with making comics, and I've never looked back. But I ended up with a big Spider-Man like encyclopedia. And so I knew what that Amazing Spider-Man 300 meant. And I was like, Dad, I would love that comic book. And he looked at the price, $80. And he was like, yeah, that's cute, kid. And we bought like a few of like the new issues off the stands in the comic shop and maybe like some $2 back issues or whatever.
Sure.
And then for Christmas that year, I got that Spider-Man. He went back the very next day and bought that book for me. And I'm so thankful, one, because my dad is fantastic. But
he's
also
awesome. I've got tears in my eyes. That is a wonderful story. I love your dad. Tell your dad that Christian Horn loves him, and he'll be like, who? And tell him to stop. But I think that that's such a wonderful story. You must have opened that package and just been like, oh my God.
I had forgotten about it. I was like, it was months later.
Oh, dad rules.
Yeah.
That's so great.
But there was no going back with comics. So that's always been my first love. There's like I love film and music and video games, but I like the singular experience of a comic book or even a novel, but my attention span has been burned to a crisp by comics, so it's mostly just comics now.
Sure.
So that insular kind of, it's just me and the book, and it just offers something that movies don't or music can't. And I mean, I love video games probably just a little bit less than comic books, but I've never wanted to like write for TV. I've never wanted to make film. I went to film school because I was like, you know, if it would be interesting. I want to see how these work. And television I always liked more than film anyway. So I was like, you know, TV would be cool, but it was all in the service of learning how to write specifically in like script formats, because that's how we write comics.
Sure.
It was, so I went to college for the express purpose of finding out how to like be a better writer, and through that make better comics. It always leaves a sour taste in my mouth when people are like, I couldn't sell this movie script, so I'm going to make it a comic, or yeah, I'm making this comic to sell my movie pitch. I'm like, dude, comics are right here. They're not lucrative, but damn it, they're art, and they're the best art. That's where it is. Like, this is where Kirby lived. This is where Grant Morrison lives. Like, this is where Ditko and Lee and Moore, like, this is where all the great creative minds are. And they're so punk, and you can do anything with them. It blows my mind that people would want to do anything else.
Sure. Well, Dalton, you are warming my heart, because as an old man, I mean, I love hearing this. Well, I mean, that is sort of the thing and the question that's sort of been like lingering out in the ether sphere for me, or the internet, is this, you know, as a parent myself, you know, and kind of looking at it from your dad's side, like, you're like, there is no second, you know, option other than comics. But like, my question is always like, okay, can creators just make a living or doing, you know, can you pay your bills? Can you pay the insurance? Can you, you know, the car insurance, medical insurance and stuff like these days, just off of comics alone? And so that is always sort of like, it's great to hear you speak in passionate tones about this art form. And I agree with you 100%. And hearing you say like Morrison and Kirby and like all, you know, your stuff, but as far as like, there is no second plan, I'm like, Dalton, are you sure there's no second plan? Cause I want you to be able to eat and stuff like that. So what is your sort of, you know, and again, there are people out there who are probably making a living, you know, making comics and, you know, but you do tend to, or the, maybe not the cream rises to the top, but sometimes the sourness rises to the top, and you hear people like, I made an indie book and I barely got out of the black, or I'm still in debt, or, you know, so how does that work in your mind, to ask a personal question in a way?
Yeah. The 21st century has single-handedly made it easier than ever to be an artist and reach an audience, and harder than it's ever been.
Yeah. Interesting.
The democratization of the internet is so fantastic, but it makes it so hard to be heard in a sea of everyone wanting to do that as well.
Sure.
I mean, back in the day, you could go to New York and walk right up to DC or Marvel and get an internship and then work your way up into the big leagues, or go to California and do, you know, indie comics. You had to travel, but now you don't.
Yeah.
And spaces like Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and now even TikTok, like you can easily throw your stuff out there, but it's algorithm based. And so you have to play by certain rules. So corporations, like they've always done, are making it harder than ever for people to actually be happy. So it's really hard to be seen, and especially to turn a profit in an art form like comics.
Yeah.
I do have a day job. I think pretty much everyone on the team, Mary probably notwithstanding, has a day job.
Yeah.
Like, it's, especially as a writer, that's why I keep trying to work on my art, so that I don't have to be so reliant on a team. As great as a team is, as great as collaboration is, like, the day, as a writer, you can only do so much. Like, at the end of the day, the writer is the least essential member of a creative team when it comes to comics, because Mary's talented enough. She doesn't need us. Like, it's...
Do you think so? That's an interesting take, because I tend to interview a lot of writers on here, and, you know, I've had experience with writers, people that I've worked on books with or tried to work on, you know, and stuff like that. And I mean, I feel sometimes that the writing is very important, But in a way, and I'm not disparaging writers for God's sake, but there is a part of me that feels like that this may be, and God, don't come at me. I love writers. I think you're very important. But I think that, like, as far as grinding it out, like the artist, the colorist, like all that stuff, that is a bit more work, maybe, if I'm...
Oh, absolutely.
So
I can bang out a script in an afternoon. Okay. It's nothing.
Oh my God, don't say that, because it's not nothing. No, trust me, I am not. No, it is not nothing. Writers, it is not nothing. I respect you. I respect what you do. Like,
oh, no, I respect every writer. I'm just saying, like, direction's important. All right.
Sure.
Like, I'm not trying to say that, like, Wells and I are non-essential personnel, because, like, Frankenstein wouldn't exist without
me. And the writing is good on this book, so you are essential to this book. Yeah.
You need direction. You need thematic through lines. Like, if the Image Comics of 92 through 94 taught us anything, is that pretty art can sell a book.
Yeah.
But it doesn't necessarily have to be great. But comics are also a medium that one person can do everything, and it's phenomenal. Like, you look at any, heck, Brian Lee O'Malley with Scott Pilgrim, that's all him.
Yeah.
And that became one of the most successful indie books of the, like, early 2010s. Writers are, I love writers. Morrison is my favorite figure in comics. Like,
okay.
I don't think I've read a bad Grant Morrison story, but Kirby is the person who's like the mythic figure, right? Like,
sure.
Kirby was the artist. Kirby was, and then in the 70s when Kirby went and was doing his own stuff with Fourth World and Kamandi and the Demon, like, that's the stuff that really kind of lights the fire. Morrison is the guy who makes me a better writer and makes me come, like, understand themes and makes me cry, but Kirby sets off the artistic drive, that primal kind of, I can do it all here. And I think that's kind of like, that's where the divide is. Like, artists don't need writers, but writers need artists. And that is what makes being an indie writer specifically so taxing, because it's all out of pocket, right? Especially in this, like, we're not breaking even here in indie comics.
Sure.
Like, it's all resume builders until the right eye see it. And then, like, you can maybe get a big two work, and that way you can build your audience enough that you can go do your own work again.
Yeah. It's so weird the way that cycle works, where it's like, much, you're like, how do I break into Marvel or DC or Image or whatever? And it's like, well, go make your own thing. And then it's like, you got to pour, you know, like you said, if you're a writer, you got to pour money into it, and then you got to use Kickstarter and all this stuff. It's interesting though, because I think that the balance of that is like, you know, you look at those early Image books and it's like, no, you guys need a writer. Like, there's definitely people who were in that stable who were immensely talented artists, but you look at the writing, and maybe after the first couple of books, you were sort of like, you know. And it also can be very hard to do everything by yourself. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
As somebody like myself who has his little hobby book and, you know, draws it, writes it, colors it, letters it, does it all, because I need to save money. You know what I mean?
No,
and I don't want to pay. My kid needs to go to college. You know? So, yeah. I mean, for me, it's very much like, it's the necessity of having to do everything by myself. But I think if anything, it's interesting, the balance between writers and artists. I think that the early Image years were very much kind of like an argument against, like, writers not necessarily being important, because you can only take that for so long, right? There were only, because I think, like, so, like, somebody like Jim Lee, like, let's just use him as an example, right? Like, you can look at Jim Lee, and you can read Jim Lee for like 6 months, 7 months, 8 months, but after a while, there's a similarity that sinks in, and you're sort of like, okay, maybe I've got enough Jim Lee for now. His art isn't the thing that's going to draw me to this anymore, you know, if the writing is bad, you know what I'm saying? Whereas...
Yeah, it's kind of the same thing, those Image books at the time, and you can say the same thing for, like, the Marvel books at the time, once Image left.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the Image books were so artistically driven that those guys, and they, those guys are making so much money that they never felt they needed to learn how to write stories.
Sure,
like they had all of it, they had all of this talent in the artistic field, but couldn't handle it on the writer's side, and it became just like this this comic book junk food. But yeah. Then you look at what Marvel was doing, like Tom DeFalco books are comic book fast food. Like that guy doesn't like those kind of books, those kind of corporate Marvel books that are there just to keep the number going up on the issue count. Like none of that was severely deep. Like it's I wouldn't call it art. Like those guys needed the artists just as much as the artists needed them to keep a book going. Like yeah. That's why big two corporate books are so dependent on a collaborative effort.
Sure.
Like Batman can be art, but most Batman isn't art. And the indie sphere, opens up more opportunities for like one guy to do everything.
Sure.
Or if you're not there artistically or aren't there story-wise, then you can definitely work with somebody else. And that makes great comics. That makes Frankenstein.
Yeah, but, yeah, yeah.
But it's it can be difficult. It's difficult to break that bottom line there at the end of the day.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, I first of all, let me say just how impressed I am with you, because I mean, you were literally being born at the time around that Image Revolution, and for you to know your stuff like about like what happened and what those books were like at that time, that very much impresses me. I lived through it, and I bought so many of those books and just was so wrapped up in it, and just like again, a little bit to my regret, but at the same time, there was some really gorgeous art, you know.
Oh, I'm a Todd McFarlane stan at the end of the day. Like,
oh, really?
I love McFarlane's work.
Okay.
Dude makes me uncomfortable sometimes, but damn it if he doesn't, like, make me go, yeah, F the man.
Yeah, yeah. I think that is one of his great draws, is that he's very much like, hey, you know, make your thing, do your thing, and stuff like that. I'm definitely more of a kind of like a Jim Lee, Mark Silvestri guy. Silvestri impresses me too. I love Jim Lee's detail and stuff, but sometimes there's a bit of a stiffness in his work, but there's an energy to Silvestri where I'm just like, dude, like, it's just like, what is going on here? Like, especially, and Silvestri is one who to me has developed through the years, like has just gotten better and better. You could tell that he works at it, you know, not saying Jim Lee doesn't, not saying McFarlane doesn't, but, you can look at like Silvestri's work now and look at like his X-Men stuff and be like, oh, this has, there's been some growth here. You know what I'm saying? That's so interesting to me. Yeah, no, I mean, I find it, fascinating. Like, just I always find the indie artists and stuff like that fascinating, because it's like, okay. And the Kickstarter stuff, because I mean, there have been people who have told me like, oh, you got to jump into Kickstarter. And I'm like, no, I don't need the anxiety, but I mean, it's great that you're doing this. I mean, because again, it is such a solid looking and a solid read, especially for somebody like me who is a fan of this stuff. Like how, I mean, I just keep going back to, like, how did you sort of like get started with this? Because you said you went to sort of film school. Why did you, I mean, Frankenstein kind of like became one of your favorites, but like, why not superheroes? Why not, you know, straight up sci-fi? Why not? Was there just too much superheroes for you? Or were you just like, I want to do something horror oriented? Or
so superheroes are my bread and butter. Like,
okay.
I'll talk crap about big two superhero comics all day, but I mean, I'm buying Justice League every month. Like, I'm not, I'm not above that.
Sure. I love them too.
Yeah. I love superheroes, and everyone who likes superheroes has a superhero story they want to tell.
Sure.
But superheroes define the market in so many ways that it's almost eye roll inducing whenever I see indie, like Kickstarters with superheroes.
Sure.
Because I'm like, I've seen it, and I'm sure your indie superhero book is great, but like, I can get superheroes like McDonald's. I can just go down to McDonald's and get a superhero book.
Yeah.
I love seeing the different genres and the passion projects. And so, yeah, we have superhero stuff like on the back, but that's like, nobody wants to read our superhero crap. They want to see the fresh stuff. That's when we first started working together. We exclusively were writing horror and sci-fi. A lot of those ash cans, Frankenstein was one of them, but we also had a sci-fi line, a strictly horror line, and we even had an all ages line where we were just telling stories in 8 pages at a rapid clip. We just wanted to experiment and kind of find our collaborative voice because Wells and I are just plain straight up different writers. He is a very methodical writer who likes to take it an issue at a time. He's very thematically oriented. His characters are great and grounded. But my work is very fast paced, a lot of momentum, a lot of action, a lot of dialogue, that the characters tend to interact a little smoother. So when we work together, we really balance each other out in that regard to where it becomes like an actual whole.
Sure.
And those ash cans and experimenting with different genre really helped us find that voice that has led to Mechaton and Frankenstein. And horror always sold well at the booth at conventions. Mm-hmm. The ash cans always sold really well. And then when we actually got Descent into Dread published through Caliber Comics, that was all horror. Like all of our horror ash cans plus a few brand new stories got turned into this anthology. People love horror, and horror is like, I don't know, it's fun to write, especially like the action horror of Frankenstein. So I'm really drawn to the over the top genre stuff, which is what Frankenstein definitely is.
Sure.
And
I would imagine mixing genres, right?
Yes. I'm never really content just to do like just a straight up genre piece. I like to kind of, if not mix and match, then at least pull a few ingredients here and there from other genres to really really make it something, or at least try to make it something unique. Like I don't want to. We have a story in that Dread anthology that's a slasher, but it's not just a slasher. It's like we added sci-fi elements into it and like a Buffy-ism to it to make it a slasher that stands out.
Sure.
And Frankenstein is definitely that. We weren't content with just making a barbarian book. We wanted to make it a horrific, monster-filled, cosmic, crazy, over-the-top barbarian book that not even Conan can do.
Well, that is true. I mean, so you mentioned that Wells is kind of like a different kind of writer than you are. How does your working relationship go? Like, how like, is somebody coming up with a premise for the issue and then you send it to him and he like writes things out? You said he's issue by issue. Are you creating the arcs and then you kind of like go back and forth? How does that work between the two of you?
Yeah, it's smoothed out over the years, thankfully.
Okay. Thankfully,
because like as with any collaboration,
sure,
especially with writers, like heads butt. But
I didn't say it well as he did.
No. He'd be saying it too. We've given each other aneurysms many times, but we've reached a place where things are smooth and like, so like with Frankenstein, whenever we pick a project, somebody takes the lead.
Okay.
Which means they'll plot it out. And then they have kind of final say on the script. So with Frank, I have the lead, and so I write the first issue, and then I send it to Wells, and he gives it a second pass, and usually by the third, I'll get it for the third pass, and usually by then, things are kind of ironed out and good to go. Maybe a few dialogue tweaks here and there, but we have like we have it page by page set up. We're good there.
Mm-hmm.
I like to kind of just kind of spit up the whole story. So like with Frankenstein, we have it planned for 13 issues and
oh, wow.
I wrote those 13 issues in like a month.
Oh, wow.
I was like, no, I can't, when I start, I can't stop. I just want to just go and go and go until it's done.
Sure, sure.
Wells is very much, let's take it issue by issue, arc by arc, because if things change, we don't want to have to be changing too much. And I agree with him, but I also like to kind of like have the piece of marble and start kind of like chipping away at it here and there.
Gotcha, gotcha.
I like as few edits as possible. So having like the whole thing in front of me, I know where we're at, I know where we're beat by beat, and then Wells can get in there with the chisel and start being like, okay, does this make sense? Does this work? Do we need something here? And that kind of thing.
Sure.
So it's been working out very, very well. Frankenstein and Mechaton both. He has lead on Mechaton, so we're going issue by issue in that regard.
Okay.
It's been working well both ways.
Is Mechaton currently up on Kickstarter, or is that something else that's coming up? Or
actually, just wrapped our Kickstarter for issue 3 on Mechaton.
Oh, cool. All right.
Yeah, we alternate between Mechaton and Frankenstein. Mechaton is our like rule of cool sci-fi series about two siblings who find a glove that fell from space, and they find out that anything they punch turns into a giant robot that they can use to fight kaiju.
That sounds amazing.
So the first issue, they punch a hot dog cart, and the second, they punch a house and then a car, and it just keeps getting crazier and crazier and crazier.
So this sounds more like a kid's book or something like that, younger.
It is. It's distinctly more all ages. Okay. Frank and Mechaton are very different books, and we love them both for it.
Sure, sure, sure.
We like to have a spread of genre. Like, it sucks to be pigeonholed as, like, the horror writer. Like,
sure.
We like to show that we have a little breadth with our story.
How's that work at your table, though? I mean, if you've got like a Frankenstein, like, do kids get freaked? Like, do parents like kind of like see the kids' brightly colored book or something, or all ages, and then they see the Frankenstein next to it? Does that freak people? Does that like? I mean, the Frankenstein cover is, there's nothing like scary or gross on it or anything like that. But how does that work between both, like at a convention, like let's say?
Hopefully, the kid picks up Mechaton and the dad picks up Frankenstein.
Yeah. Right? Oh, nice.
Cool. No, usually we don't have a whole lot of problems with it. Usually, like they'll grab Mechaton for their kid, or they'll just ignore the table completely. Like it hasn't been a wrench in any sort of work to try and sell them both at the table at the same time. Like we've been doing that kind of thing since our ash cans, because like I said, we did horror, we did Frankenstein, we did sci-fi, and we had an all ages line.
Sure.
So we had like ratings on the covers so that they knew which ones were great for kids and which weren't.
Cool.
And you know, if the kid sounds cool, I might slip him a Frankenstein.
But hey kid, are you cool? Here's a book with a guy ripping somebody's arm off. Like, there you go.
I don't want to narc at my table, so I got to make sure that I can slip him a Frank without too much trouble. No, it hasn't been too much of an issue, thankfully.
Nice, nice, nice. That's great. That's great. Well, let me ask you this. You mentioned Conan. How did you get into Conan? Because, I mean, I've asked you every other, like, how did that get made? Was it the movie, the Conan the Barbarian, or were you reading the books, or?
I'll be frank. I haven't actually dipped my toes into a lot of Conan.
Oh, interesting.
It's one of those things I've admired from a distance for a while. So you can call me a bit of a poser, because I love the aesthetics of barbarian fiction. But I've never actually dipped my toes into barbarian fiction.
So have you not seen the Conan movie yet? The Schwarzenegger one?
No, I have not seen the Schwarzenegger one.
I love the Schwarzenegger movie. It is excellent. I am going to make a public invitation to you, because we do podcasts about movies and stuff like that every once in a while. And if you want to watch the first Conan movie, I will rewatch it. And we could talk about it, because I would love to see what you think, like, having never seen it before. It's one of my favorites, but if you want to do that, I will have you back on, and we could talk about Conan, because I love that movie, at least the first one. They made a second one, and it's not as good, but...
Yeah, no, I am definitely there for that. I did check out Jason Aaron's, like, reboot of the Marvel Conan, and I like the first few issues of that, mostly because of Mahmoud Asrar's art. I've read quite a few of like the old Roy Thomas Conan stuff from Marvel as well.
Those are so good.
So, So I did research. I don't want to fly by the seat of my pants, but I've never really engaged with it as like a fan would. I have a friend who is obsessed with Conan, has all the books, movies, comics, like they love Conan. And I've always loved the aesthetics of Conan, like that heavy narration, the swords and sorcery. But I also wanted to take that barbarian fiction and really like add some sci-fi elements, add more monsters, maybe add a bit of thematic irony through it. That's not just muscular guy kills dragon and beds the lady. Which I'm sure somebody's going to come at me and be like, not all Conan is like that. Now I know that, but
yes,
we're talking aesthetically here.
Yeah. Yeah. As crazy as it is to say, there is a depth to that first Schwarzenegger movie. It's not very deep, but there's some like really good stuff in there that to me just makes it like fantastic. And, I love it. So let me wrap this up with just asking you, you're a fan of Frankenstein. Have you ever read the book?
Yes, actually.
Okay.
Love the novel.
Me too.
I'm planning on during the actual campaign that starts on September 19th. Just so happens that just about for every day of the campaign is the same amount of chapters in the novel. So I'm thinking about maybe starting up like a little Frankenstein book club during the campaign.
Oh, smart.
So like every day we'll do like a chapter of the Frankenstein novel. The book is gripping. It's great. And a lot of those like under the surface themes of the novel that don't necessarily get explored too much, we kind of wanted to bring to the surface with Unconquered. Like I said, it is a sequel to the novel. You don't have to read the novel to really get what's going on.
Yeah.
But we do kind of carry on those themes of like maybe Frank isn't as much of a victim as he likes to think he is. Maybe he is a bit of a monster. Maybe Victor is the real monster and his son just happened to inherit those monstrous traits. And there's a lot of meat in the novel that a lot of it does get explored, but some of it is just kind of like glossed over. And I'm like, I kind of wanted more of that. So we're kind of in the novel and making Mary Shelley roll over in her grave and giving you Frankenstein with a sword.
Nice, nice. Any thoughts on the Kenneth Branagh adaptation? Have you seen it?
I've not seen that one. Okay. No.
Yeah, you can skip it. how about, have you seen, I'm just throwing stuff out at you now. Penny Dreadful, that series?
No, I haven't said that. It's hard for me to sit and get invested in a television show, especially
when it's
so busy. But man, I've heard nothing but good things.
If you're into all this stuff, it just takes it on a delightful, amazing, like hardcore spin. And the Frankenstein character in that is just fantastic. Okay. They nailed it. So I would highly, not just to you, but to anyone listening, if you have not seen Penny, and I think it's on Netflix right now. I'm not sure, but I love it. I may do a rewatch during Halloween, during October, because I've loved it so much. But that's great. Well, I have to say thank you for joining me, Dalton. I really enjoyed this book. It's a pleasure chatting with you. The Kickstarter, you said, kicks off on the 19th, which may be several days after this goes up. But there must be a pre-launch page, correct?
Absolutely. That pre-launch page is live right now.
Okay.
We're offering issue 1 and 2 if you missed the first Kickstarter campaign. So don't worry if you missed it. You can grab both. Hey, the Wolfman's in this one. Oh. And the Bride.
So, nice. Very cool. I love it.
We're gearing up for a hell of a ride with Frankenstein. And it's so much fun.
Well, I very much enjoyed the first issue. I like this book, Frankenstein, the Unconquered. The second issue, like you said, will be on Kickstarter September 19th, correct?
Yes.
Your name is Dalton K. Shannon. It has been a pleasure chatting with you. I very much enjoyed this project. I wish you all the best luck in the world. And like I said, if you want to come back on we've never talked about the original, the Conan the Barbarian movie. If you want to do that, I would love to have you back on at some point.
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah. This has been so much fun. Thank you so much for having me. It's always great to talk to somebody about comics and monsters and everything in between.
Absolutely.
And I'll be glad to come back and do a Conan watch.
Yeah, and I am just absolutely, I love it when I meet somebody who's from like literally kind of like a different generation, and they are very much you know, like all your shit, like you've got it all down, you've got the history all down, you know what's going on. So I am very impressed, young man.
And, oh gee, thanks.
I hope that doesn't sound condescending, but anyway, the book is Frankenstein the Unconquered, Kickstarter September 19th. I have been chatting with Dalton K. Shannon. Any final words? Where can people find you, like on the interwebs and stuff?
Yeah, I am at Dalton K. Shannon on any social media that matters.
Gotcha. And you have your DaltonKShannon.com, correct?
Correct. That website is undergoing maintenance. I'm getting ready to launch a solo project here in the next few months. So that website's not looking its best right now, but, okay, but hopefully by next year that thing will be up and running.
Okay, so Dalton K. Shannon on social media. That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. All right, Dalton K. Shannon, Frankenstein the Unconquered, Kickstarter September 19th. My name is Christian Horn. This is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. You could check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all that wonderful social media stuff. Our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. Please go support Frankenstein the Unconquered when it launches. There will be links on the parttimefanboy.com website. And thank you for listening, and we will be back soon with another episode. Bye. Part-time fanboy.